everyone, and welcome to another edition of Meat Trapper Radio. Now tonight I'm going to answer some listeners' questions, some emails, because they have been piling up, and I apologize to everybody who's emailed questions in. I have been quite busy in my personal life. As you know, there was no episode last week. And basically, I've been dealing with some things in my personal life that have taken up a lot of time and have been quite emotionally intensive to deal with. And without getting into a lot of details, because it's simply not necessary, I had to pull my son out of public school and start homeschooling him recently because of some things that had happened at school, specifically with the school administration. And it took up a lot of my time, but now that everything is going, it all turned out for the best, and it has been one of the best things that I've ever done, and I wish I had done it years ago. So if any of you have any questions about homeschooling, or if you have any problems that you're dealing with at the schools, feel free to email me, meattrapper@gmail.com, and I'll be happy to share my experience with you, and the pros and the cons of the whole thing. But suffice it to say that you simply don't know what's going to happen on any given day, and your line in the sand, it may be crossed at any time, and you have to be ready and willing to deal with it. There's just no other way to put that. So let's talk about a couple of questions and comments that I received by email recently. One of the more interesting emails that I received is from Rafael, R-A-F-A-L. I hope I'm pronouncing your name right, sir. But it's a very cerebral and very philosophical email that he sent me, and it's quite interesting, really. He says, "Hello, Mr. Meat Trapper. I've been a fan of your YouTube channel and your broadcast on Trapping Radio for a while now. I appreciate the no-nonsense approach you have. Common sense is a thing of the past these days. It's refreshing to hear. Without making this email too long, I was wondering if you could at some point touch on the balance and harmony in nature. You see, like most people of my age, in my 40s, I've been told certain things since a very young age that appear to be false. I think there is a reason they call it programs in school. I could make a very long list, but I won't. Two subjects that have sparked some recent research by myself have been the Native American Indians and nature itself. I have found some material that appears to be a closer representation to Native American culture of old than, say, Dancing with Wolves, PBS, or other movies. It's a very interesting read, and it has shocked me how different reality appears to have been from what I was told throughout my life. Please note, I am not one to judge, just interested in the truth. A link, if you care to check for yourself, is at the end of this email." My question to you is nature in perfect harmony and balance, as we are told since birth? Or is it a hard, even cruel and unforgiving place, where man is not this invading, destructive element, but actually the best part of it? Or put there is a warden of some sorts. After all, animals do not have morality or justice, do they? There is balance in nature, but isn't it brutal? I was having a discussion with a friend about rabbit cooking and hunting, and it shocked me that this person said they could never kill and skin one. But I think this is the same person would eat his shoes if hungry enough, but I don't get where this guilt comes from. I feel it too sometimes. Yes, I was raised in a big city. Heck, I'm sure that rabbit would not hesitate to eat me if it could. Why am I, and many men like me, so soft in the face of something that is actually beautiful, but very brutal? Or am I just way overthinking all of this?" And then Rafael includes a link in his email, and it's from a white paper from Ohio State University, and it talks, it's a very interesting reading. What it does is it goes back to the early explorers and when the Jesuits were interacting with the Indians. And it explores all of the old texts, and it talks about their firsthand reports of living with the Indians, the Mohawks and the Iroquois and all of that, and how they engaged in cannibalism and the savage torture and burning captives alive, and how they would do it extremely slowly, and they would spend all night burning someone and torturing someone. And it's interesting reading, but he's absolutely right in that you never see that on stuff like Dances with Wolves or on PBS or anything else. You know, for instance, today is Columbus Day. And here in the United States, the Antifa people are all out tearing down and defacing statues of Columbus, you know, and they're not celebrating Columbus Day because he was a tyrant and he killed people. They're all celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day. But, you know, and the Indigenous peoples were out there killing each other and engaging in cannibalism and engaging in torture and burning people alive. And if you look at historical fact, there's very little difference in the behavior of the first Europeans who came over and the Indians that they encountered that were already here. But of course, you can't say that. You're not allowed to say that. And so you're right, Raphael. You have been lied to. You've been lied to your entire life. And that's very intentional. You see, if you can be made to feel guilty about what happened hundreds of years ago, then you can be made to pay for what happened hundreds of years ago. It's nothing but extortion, and it's political extortion as well as economic extortion. What I would find funny is floating the idea that Native Americans owe reparations to Europeans here in America because of the way that they tortured Europeans that they encountered. You know, there would be screams and howls of outrage if you floated that idea. But it's just as valid as it is the other way around. But at a deeper level, what you're talking about here is, to me, the essence of man. And is man an animal, no different from a tiger or a raccoon or a wolf? Or is man imbued with a sense of morality and justice because he is not a part of nature? And I think you summed it up pretty well when you said, is nature in perfect harmony and balance, or is it a hard, cruel, and unforgiving place? And my answer to that is yes. Because you see, the natural world is in harmony and balance, and it is cruel and unforgiving. And there's a lesson to be learned there. And that lesson is, when we divorce ourselves and remove ourselves from the laws of nature, we create imbalances that, when nature does correct them, are far more cruel and far more brutal than they would have been. And a classic example of this is how we have allowed how we have changed our agricultural practices so that we can feed a huge number of people. And we have cities and urban areas that have tens of millions of utterly dependent people on them. And when there's a food crisis, those people are going to starve. And rather than it being a cruel environment where a small number of people starve, it's going to be an extremely cruel scenario where millions of people starve. And this is something that Barry touched on in a previous episode. It's the same concept, really. And of course, as far as what separates us from the animals, as a Christian, I believe that we have a spirit. And that spirit is what sets us apart from the animals. And so, yes, we are a part of nature and we are subject to nature's laws, but we are apart from nature's beings in that respect. And so I thought that was a very interesting email, Raphael, and I really appreciate it. It's very thought-provoking, and you know, we could do several shows on all of that. It's fascinating stuff. Now, I had another question, and I thought this was a great question. It's one that I get a lot, and I've talked about it a little bit in the past, but I'd like to sort of revisit it simply because I get this question so much. And this one is from Ryan, and Ryan's up in Canada, a long way away from here. And he talks about he's begun trapping nuisance beavers on properties, and he's interested in adding them into his food, becoming more self-sufficient, and he's been butchering them at home. And he gets to the meat of the subject, and he says, well, the results that I've had have been mixed, which is the reason for this message. I'm having trouble getting rid of the woody bark taste in the meat and the hint of castor that seems to come with it, though I am very careful about removing the glands and the oil sacs. Your meals on YouTube look so mouthwatering that I can't help but think I'm doing something wrong. I usually soak the meat in brine for a day, and then often in apple cider vinegar for a few hours. This has worked well with the back straps and the ribs, which were quite good. The roasts, by which I mean the rumps and the front shoulders, however, often have that woody castor taste that I find unpleasant, despite prolonged brining. As well, last night I cooked up the liver from a recent beaver, and despite soaking it in salted soda water and milk for hours, it was still bitter and bark-flavored. So he's looking for some advice. He'd like to improve it and all of his results and all of that. Now, Ryan, what I'm going to tell you is what I do. I've never trapped in Canada. I've never eaten beaver trapped in Canada. I'm from the southeastern United States, the deep south. But you know, an animal is an animal. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to share with you how I process them, what I do, and what I believe. Now, the first thing is I'm very big on trying to keep the beaver alive until I get there and dispatch it. So I do not want to walk up to a dead beaver or a drowned beaver if I can avoid it. Now, you live in a very cold climate, so you're going to be able to get away with stuff that I can't, okay? So that's rule number one. I want it alive when I get there, if at all possible. Now down here, I will eat beavers trapped in a conibear and killed, but only on the coldest days. Okay, and I'm trying to get there at first light in that case. So that's keeping the meat alive and fresh as much as possible. Rule number two is butcher them as soon as possible after dispatch. A lot of times for me, that's on the tailgate of my truck as soon as I get off the water. I would rather do it there and be in a place where I can go ahead and dispose of whatever remains that I want to dispose of, as well as get to the meat while it's still warm and still fresh. This is especially important with the liver. I love beaver liver. Now, it has a strong flavor. It's nowhere near as strong as deer liver, but it's stronger than calf liver. Now, when removing the liver, it's important not to bust the little bile sac that's right there on front of it. Keep that liver clean. And one of the best things that I've found is I carry a little pair of game shears or scissors that I can cut through the ribs. And I can cut the connective tissues and everything off. I have no problem using a pair of scissors or game shears. I get that liver out first. When I split that beaver open, that liver's the first thing that comes out. I want that organ as fresh as possible. I want it as clean as possible. And if it does have some other body fluids that get on it, I want to rinse it. Rinse it in clean water, and then put it in a baggie and get it, pat it dry, put it in a baggie, and get it cold. And it's, the reason I say get it cold is because a lot of times it's still warm down here when I'm trapping. You probably don't have that issue. Now, the next thing is when I get down around the castor glands, when I'm skinning down, and I'm down around the castor glands, oil sacs, and all of that, I grab that entire area, that entire package with everything, and cut it out and pull it free and deal with the castor glands and the oil sacs separately. My primary focus is on the food, so I want to just grab a handful of all of that junk and I slice it out as cleanly as possible and I pull down away from the animal. In other words, when I cut and pull, I want everything pulled off away from the meat so that if anything leaks or drips, it's not on the meat. And once again, that's important. Now, I don't care how careful you are, when you're trapping beaver in season, there's going to be castor all over them, okay? They're going to have squirted castor. And so what I do is when I go to trim the meat, I pick up a separate knife. Because you see, I like my meat trapper skinning knife for making that opening cut and for skinning the pelt off and all of that. And then I'll grab that package of all the glands and cut that out. But that knife has cut through the fur, and it's going to have castor on it. It's going to have oil on it because the oil is in the fur. And when you split down around the glands and everything, there's going to be castor on that blade. And if you start cutting the meat off with that same blade, you're putting hints of castor on that meat. And so I'll grab a clean blade. In other words, I have a skinning blade and I have a meat blade. I will also change gloves. Why do I wear gloves? It's not because I'm afraid of contamination, but when I have my, I'll wear the latex gloves, and it's because I'm handling the beaver. I've got mud, or I've got the oil from the fur, the castor from the fur, all of that's on those gloves. I'll take that pair of gloves off once I've got him skinned and I've got the package pulled out. I'll put on a fresh pair of gloves, pick up a meat knife that's clean, and then I start trimming away. I am very careful and very particular about this because the meat's the whole reason that I'm working my ass off to do this. And if I'm not willing to invest two pairs of cheap latex gloves and to bring an extra knife along, I mean, that's pennies that we're talking about. And so by using that clean blade and clean gloves, I'm not contaminating that meat. Okay? There's no way. And I'll bone it out, you know, separate it into quarters, pull the back straps out, all of that. And if there's any doubt, I'll simply toss the meat or use it as bait. So that's the first two rules. Try and keep the animal alive until you get there. And number two, just use common sense when you're cleaning it and realize you've got two separate and distinct operations going on. Skinning and removing the dirty part, and then butchering the meat. Two separate and distinct things. If you think about a cow, they don't butcher the cow. They don't make the steaks at the slaughterhouse. That's two separate operations. One operation is killing the cow, and the other operation is cutting the cow into steaks. It's done. One's done by a slaughterhouse. One's done by a butcher or a meat processor. So separate those two functions. The next thing is all of this soaking and brining and all of this stuff. I think a lot of this is just handed down old wives' tales. I don't soak meat. I don't soak deer meat. I don't soak beaver meat. I don't soak any meat. If you go to a slaughterhouse and they kill a steer and they start with that steer, processing that steer, they don't go and drop that steer in a giant vat of buttermilk. Think about it. They don't.
Nobody drops a cow in vinegar water and lets it soak for a couple of days. Now, what I think happens in a lot of this is if you had a small section of meat that got contaminated with castor, okay, let's say you rubbed a blade up against a piece of one of the hams or something. If you put that in water, that's going to dissolve and it's going to permeate all of it. In my opinion, and this is just my opinion, water is the enemy of meat. If you go to the store and you buy a steak, nobody drops it in milk or buttermilk. Nobody brings home a ribeye and drops it in vinegar. At least if they do around me, they're going to get their butt kicked. So why do we have to do that with a beaver? In my world and in my way of thinking, I want the meat cool, cold, you know, and dry. I don't want it sitting in water. I don't want to take a hamburger patty and sit it in water. So that's my advice, Ryan, and I don't mean to come off as critical. I'm just trying to put things in perspective and to sort of maybe jar people into thinking about this in a rational manner. I mean, flesh is flesh. You know, it's that, and why you would handle beef in one way and then all of a sudden throw all of those rules away for wild game, I don't get it. So, I hope that makes sense. Like I say, every area is different, and the animals in an area are different, so I can't tell you for sure that this is going to work for you, but all I can tell you, sir, is this is what I do, and it works well for me. Keep the animal alive. Skin it as soon after death as possible. Be clean about it, and by clean I mean you divide that into the killing and the butchering, the skinning and the butchering, and use gloves. Throw the gloves away. To me, that's very important. And then keep it dry and keep it cool, and see if that improves your results. I think it will. At least I hope so. Now I've got another letter here, and then this is something that I also get a lot, and this one is from Tom, and basically Tom had painted some of his footholds. He's a land trapper, and I had done a video a while back with Rust-Oleum paint and acetone and how to mix a solution and dip your traps in with it, and it's worked very well for me. As a water trapper, it's worked really well. And so he followed these instructions and all of that. And he says they did turn out nice. I have them hanging in the weather to air out. And basically his question is, how long does it take for the smell to go away before you'd recommend them using for coyote trapping? They've been hanging now for about 8 weeks in the sun and the rain. Yesterday I tried smelling them, but I could hardly detect any paint smell. Thanks, Tom. Well, Tom, I think they're ready to go. Once again, I'm always on a. I've learned over time to not overthink things, and to simply use common sense and to get out there and do it. And what I mean by that is I don't think that people have to go to extremes with scent control in order to be successful with predators, because regardless of what's buried under that dirt, that animal's going to know that you were there. If you research bloodhounds and how bloodhounds and canines in general scent and how they smell, I mean, your body is shedding skin cells, tens of thousands of skin cells constantly. And so when you walk up to an area and you put in a dirt hole or you put in a flat set or whatever it is, you're saturating that area with skin cells. And those are going to have scent. And that animal's going to know that you were there. I mean, this is how a bloodhound tracks. Well, I'll oversimplify it. This is one way that a canine detects scent. Because there are dogs that detect scent on the ground. There are dogs that detect scent in the air. But it's the same basic principle, and that is the cells, physical parts of your body that are floating around and dropping to the ground is what it amounts to. And when you think about the areas that we trap, there's fences, barbed wire fences, there's vehicles, there's trucks, there's farm implements, there's boats running up and down, there's smells and steel and all of and petroleum scents. I mean, think about the exhaust in the air. And so don't get hung up on how many weeks do you have to let traps air out before you can put them in the ground. You know, as long as they don't have a strong smell, put them in the ground. Put them to work. To me, what's far more important is the location that you make your sets on and how you're presenting it and working with the location when you make it. So anyway, that's a good question, Tom, and I hope that is useful and helpful. Now for the second part of the show and what my topic originally was for tonight, and that is different ways of preserving your catch, preserving your food. And to me, this is something that hits home because I originally got into trapping from the prepping side. And the reason that I got into trapping is because I realized real quick that it was difficult to lay up a supply of meat for a family that would last an extended period of time. Now, normally, I put into my freezer a year's supply of meat, red meat for my family, and it had been years since I'd had to go to the store and buy meat for my family, red meat. My wife does buy chicken, and we do buy some fish, especially saltwater fish. But my situation this year was a little bit different because I had put my house up for sale, and part of putting the property on the market was I had to get everything packed away and everything, you know, cleaned up and tidy and all of that. So I didn't have a garden this year. First time in a long time that I didn't have a garden. And I had to cut my trapping short so that I didn't have a full year supply of meat in the freezer. And when my traps and everything were packed away, I couldn't go out and supplement along the way during the off season as I usually do. And to make a long story short, for the first time this year, I had to go out to the store and buy meat. And I have to tell you, it was a shock at how expensive this stuff has gotten. And then when I got it home and started cooking it, what low quality garbage it was. I mean, it was funny because I would, when I am doing venison or beaver, if I want a hamburger patty of a certain size, I make the patty that size, and that's pretty much what size it is when it's cooked. And I would bring this crap home from the store, and I'd make the same size patty, and I would have one that was half size by the time it finished cooking. It would all shrink up. And it was, you know, sort of devolved into a game of trying to guess what size patty I should make to fit the bun, you know. And of course, my son noticed it right off, and he was like, "What's wrong with these hamburgers?" I'm like, "Yeah, there's a store-bought hamburger, son. That's what's wrong with them." And so that was really eye-opening, and I was like, "Wow, this is no good." But anyway, when it comes to preserving meat or preserving your food in general, whether it's from your garden or grains or meat, there are a number of different techniques, and there's no one technique that I consider best. And so what I wanted to do is just sort of share my experiences on different methods and the pros and cons of them. Now, when it comes to meat, one of the first methods is freezing. And to me, if you can do it, that's one of the best ways, especially for a year's storage or less. And when I have frozen the meat, what I have traditionally turned to is a vacuum sealer. And to me, this is probably the most foolproof way to do it. It's very simple. You make your bag or you buy your bag, you put the meat in there, you make sure it's relatively dry, you seal it up, it pulls a vacuum, you label it, toss it in the freezer, and you're good to go. Protects against freezer burn and all of that. Now, you can do the same thing with wrapping, but you sort of have to experiment with it, and you sort of have to know how to wrap it properly. And if you're not familiar with it, you can wrap it improperly, and you can cost yourself some meat. And so if you're interested in wrapping meat, there are a lot of videos on YouTube about it, and I would try it with a small portion of meat first to make sure that you have it right. Now, when it comes to the vacuum sealers, they're all different price ranges and everything out there available. And I have a good friend who's got one of the heavy-duty Cabela's ones. I think he paid, $700 for this thing? It's an industrial quality one. And to me, the primary difference is not only the expensive ones pull a harder vacuum, which is good, but they have a higher duty cycle. And what I mean by that is how many times within 1 hour, say, that you can pull a vacuum, you can seal a package before it loses its effectiveness or it shuts down or what have you. When you buy a cheaper unit, you're only going to get so many seals in a certain amount of time compared to a larger, stronger unit. And when this, to me, this factor comes into play when you're talking about what animals. If you're sealing up one deer at a time, and that's it, you're going to process one deer and seal it up, you can get by with a lower end food saver. But if you were going to do multiple deer, let's say your situation allows you to go out and shoot two or three deer, you're going to butcher them all at the same time, and you're going to have a big party of processing the meat. Or if you live in an area where you're shooting something like an elk or a moose or something like that, you're on a different scale. You're on a different level. So take that into account when looking at your food savers. Now another, and see, to me the advantage of that is that you're not losing nutrition, and that's key. When you go and you thaw that meat out, you're going to have almost all of the original nutritional value in that meat. Now let's compare that with canning, because you can meat. I've done it before. The advantage of canning your meat is that it's pre-cooked. All you have to do is open the can, and if you want to, warm it up, but you don't have to. You can eat it right out of the can. And I have done this. So that's a big advantage, because if you were facing a grid down situation or power outage or a storm, we just had a hurricane come through here. That's my idea of redneck MREs. Open the can, you open the jar, eat it. That saves you from having to have fuel to cook it. It saves you from having to have, you know, cooking facilities if you're in a situation like that. But the downside of canning is you're going to lose nutritional value. And when you start canning meat, you're going to lose some of the texture, the original texture of the meat. So there are pros and there are cons. And so if you had a freezer full of freezer bagged meat and the lights go out, you've got a problem, because all that meat's going to go bad. You've got to have enough fuel and facilities to cook that meat. And then how do you preserve it? Whereas with canning, you've got the jars all lined up in the pantry. Whether it's green beans, venison, peas, whatever you've put in there to can, you can prepare a meal simply by grabbing the jars, open them up, And if you have a way to heat it up, heat it up. But you're going to lose nutritional value. And so that's why I don't like canning to be a mainstay of my food program. I look at canning as a supplemental way to have stuff ready to go. Now, another method of handling meat is to dehydrate it. And once again, I find that a good dehydrator is worth its weight in gold. And by good, the first thing that I look for in a dehydrator is I don't want one where the motor is on the bottom, the fan's on the bottom. I want one where the motor and fan is on the back. I use an Excalibur brand. It's a very good dehydrator. It's given me many years of service. But the fault that the Excalibur has, at least mine, is that the trays are plastic and they're not dishwasher safe. So you have to wash the trays by hand. If you jump up to a higher level, I've got another friend that has one from Cabela's, and it's got stainless steel trays. And man, that thing is nice, because when you've done 10 or 15 trays of jerky, you just put those things in the dishwasher, turn it on, and boom, you're done. Cleanup is super simple. And I'm all about quick, fast, and easy when it comes to cleanup, because cleanup is critical. Cleanliness is critical, but it's something that I can't stand doing, just being honest. Now, when you dehydrate, once again, you're going to lose texture of the original meat, okay? But you get the ability to save a lot of space. You're going to take, it takes, if I remember correctly, 6 pounds of meat to make 1 pound of jerky. It's going to keep for a very long time, especially if you take your jerky, put it in your vacuum sealer, seal it up, and toss it in the fridge. There's no telling, or in the freezer, there's no telling how long that would last. So you're sort of doing double duty on that. But so I do, throughout a season, I'll usually do 2 or 3 cycles of jerky. I've also done a very good video on my YouTube channel of making pemmican, where I'm using blueberries, grinding up jerked beaver meat, and then using coconut oil, which I love coconut oil, as the tallow. So you can check that out. I believe it's called How to Make Beaver Pemmican. It's on my YouTube channel. And that is the original survival food. And so when it comes to that, you know, which method I prefer, I do all three. I've got stuff in my freezer. I've got jerky. And then I've got stuff in cans that I've canned. And to me, that, you know, I've got, what I like to put in the freezer is the good stuff, you know, the back straps and all of that. The chunked off neck meat and stuff like that, that goes either in cans or it goes into jerky. I'm not going to put the good stuff in jerky. Now, when it comes to storing grains, flours, wheat, corn, all of that. Once again, I have a two-pronged system. My long-term end-of-the-world scenario, I have grains, whole grains, whole wheat berries, whole corn, all of that, the oats and everything. I put those first in a Mylar bag with an oxygen absorber, and I seal them with an iron. And then that oxygen absorber absorbs all of the oxygen in there, sucks it up like it's vacuum packed, and that's inside of a plastic bucket. I have tried using metal paint cans to store it in. Anything metal is going to rust over the course of 10 years. And that's, you know, I'm eating food now that I stored 10 years ago. And when I open those Mylar bags, it's as good as the day I put it in there. Now, when you do this and you prepare your grains for long-term storage, you want to make sure that you store the whole grains and not the flour, especially whole wheat flour, because it will go rancid over time. So those whole grains that are stored in Mylar bags in the plastic buckets, they never rust, and I've got stuff that's, like I say, 12 years old, and it's perfect. That's long term. Now for day-to-day stuff or for shorter term storage, once again, going back to the food saver, you can buy food savers that have a canning jar attachment. And I always thought that was kind of a gimmick until a buddy of mine said, "Hey, I've got one of these. You want to try it out?" And I said, "Yeah." So I came over with a whole bunch of quart jars, you know, ball canning jars and lids and everything. And he has a little attachment that fits over the top of it. And what I did is I filled up these jars with cornmeal, some with grits, some with whole wheat flour, and some I had pancake mix that was just add water pancake mix. Had rice, brown rice, all of this stuff. Put them in the jars, sucked a vacuum on them. What it does is it pulls a vacuum on that canning jar, that ball glass canning jar. And I think the oldest one that I had when I opened it was 3 years, and it was as good as the day I put it in there. I was shocked at how well that worked. And the advantage to this is number one, you can see the condition of the food in there. So you do, and since you want light as the enemy, you do want to keep it in a cool, dry place, a dark place, you know, in your pantry or wherever. But that worked very, very well. And it was, you know, you're getting double duty out of that food saver because you're not only pulling vacuums on stuff that you're going to put in the freezer, but with the jar attachment, you can make use of your canning jars and you can store dry goods, you know, beans, peas, flour, meal, what have you, pull a vacuum on it and store it. It worked great. And then, of course, you've got the canning jars to actually do the canning with in your pressure canner. So you see, it's just, so that's another thing to be aware of. And that worked really well because if you were out of something, instead of having to go to the store and instead of having to crack open a 5 gallon bucket for your end of the world stuff and then grind the wheat into flour, you just crack the jar open the jar up, and you had enough to do whatever you needed to do for the night. So it worked really, really well. And so I guess the bottom line that I'm trying to convey is when you look at preserving your catch, preserving your food, and storing your food, you've got to have a multi-pronged approach. You can't rely on one method or one way as a one-size-fits-all. At least I don't. So anyway, if you have any questions or have any comments, meattrapper@gmail.com. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the matter. And we came through the little Hurricane Nate here, no problem. Had some heavy rain and some wind gusts, a few branches down, but that was about it. The people on the coast down there got hit a little harder, had some flooding and power outages and all that, but that's the way it goes. But I hope each and every one of you have a wonderful week. Thank you for listening. Oh, and before we get off the subject, remember, Clint's got a new lure out, the Hammer. And I tell you, I'm getting some, and I'm not a coyote trapper. I'm not a land trapper. I'm a water trapper, and I'm a fisherman. And that's all I'm going to say, because I'm not going to give my secret away on what I'm going to use it for. But you ought to check it out. Check out the Trapper's Brigade. Everything in there. You can get a 10% off on all of the vendors. My stuff is in there. If you're looking for a good Christmas present for somebody, I've still got a few knives left. The Meat Trapper Skinner. These are absolutely beautiful, beautiful knives. And they're designed to my specification. They're hand forged by Mr. Mark Hatchett here in Alabama. And they're very nice. They'd make a wonderful present either for yourself or for somebody special in your life. But anyway, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.